Now, this is... I'm so tired I can't put sentences together. It's 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon. I came back from the airport, and I fell asleep out of sheer exhaustion, since I had to adjust my body twice in 4 days, first from Jerusalem to New York time, and back from New York time to Jerusalem time. So this is how it happened. You probably recall that we took off from Kennedy. We were airborne exactly 2:30 p.m. on Sunday.
Everyone had arrived by 20 minutes of 2. The feeling at the Orange Terminal was that
everything was in order. There were no problems. 100% attendance. We didn't even have to explain to Pomeranz why Mrs. Russell was present, or Mrs. Grismish. The problem never came up. We boarded the aircraft, and they began to feed us in traditional Jewish fashion. And between the liquor, the tea, the cookies, the cakes, the coffee, the scotch, the gin, and the card game. By the way, we didn't have enough decks of cards. But Belfer and Mailman and Rickless and Pomeranz played gin for about 8 of the 10 hours. I briefed Aviad, and then we mingled. I introduced many people to him. He introduced some people to me. And we were sailing. The dinner was fabulous. We slept in the rear. Most people on the seats. Some people did avail themselves of the coach area, which, as you recall, was prepared with pillows and quilts. It was extremely important, indispensable, that the entire plane be devoted to our guests. It was one of the crucial points in the success of the whole venture. It was like a family, and everybody began to get acquainted with everyone else. The service on the aircraft was superb. People such as Nate Sherman and others remarked while we were jumping about in the half track in the Sinai Desert that he had never been accorded such Tiffany service in his life on any airline anywhere in the world. About 2 hours out of Tel Aviv, we had lox and cream cheese and bagels, which were brought on the plane, I assure you, not from Jerusalem, but from New York. And we landed at about 8:15. The sun was shining. The beautiful girls of El Al were waiting for us with mitz tepuz, mitz eshkoliot. I handed Chaim the passports, the tickets. Only Handelman left his passport in his hold luggage, but that presented no problem. We boarded the Arkia Herald and had a beautiful flight down to Bir Gavgava. At Bir G, a few minutes later, the helicopter arrived from Jerusalem with the rest of the crew, and we were given special Israel Army hats and khaki shirts. We had a problem finding a hat that was big enough for Sherman's head, but I took care of him. And then we assembled in the briefing room where Chief of Staff Barlev explained why Israel's in good shape from the strategic point of view, but that we're indeed in a state of no war, no peace, there are casualties, it's expensive. And he was quite effective, although he spoke a little too long and didn't leave enough time for questions. Chich, General Lahat, in charge of the canal area, was point, quick, and the men appreciated the detailed briefing. We then were divided into 2 main groups, boarded the helicopters, and as soon as the helicopters took off, we were given some more bits. The boys in the helicopter were great. One aircraft moved out northward, the other moved southward. After a 25-minute helicopter ride, we alighted from the aircraft. And we were divided into four groups. Two went on half tracks towards the Mediterranean coast, and two went towards Ismailia. And in my half track, I had Nate Sherman, Mailman, Pomeranz, Rab, and Arthur Cohn. The only problem was that Fred Pomeranz, who had recently undergone an operation on his soft underbelly, as we say in Yiddish, his tuchus, kept jumping up and down and screaming bloody murder that he was not going to make it. But the half track went bumping along. We put on the steel helmets, and we looked like D-Day invasion force with the situation well in hand. We stopped first at a tank unit, and there we learned to our amazement that the boys sleep in the tank or around the tank, mostly during the day, and they're on duty at night. It's a mobile unit backing up the forces along the canal. I was the interpreter, so the boys could ask all the questions and get their answers in full detail, and it made a profound impression on all of them. Trudging back through the sand, onto the half track, back to the road, we were on our way to the canal when we realized that the other group hadn't left the post, so we turned off again and visited an artillery unit. We saw a new piece of Israeli equipment. Very impressive. They put through a mock firing performance, and then we got back on the half track. By this time, Mailman's leg was bothering him, and I offered to have them taken back to the original camp where the helicopter landed, but Fred Pomeranz said, "I came all this goddamn way. I'm exhausted, and I'm going to see that goddamn canal." So we moved forward. So I said, "Kadima, yalla." We moved forward, and we went tearing down the road in that half track. Pomeranz screaming again about his behind. So somebody said to him that his ass is bleeding for Pomeranz. We get to the post on the canal. It was 600 meters from the other side. And we spoke with the boys, and again we had mitts. And we had to do it very quickly because we had to get back, since we were behind schedule. But Pomeranz said, "No, I gotta see that goddamn canal." So we had to go up on the Tatzpit, they call it in Hebrew, the outlook point where the Israeli sharpshooters are. And there was a sign marked, "Beware of snipers shooting from the other side," in Hebrew, of course, Tzalafim. But Pomeranz insisted, so I told the officer, "Look, we got to make him happy." And the others were also quite curious. So after we went into the bunkers, we saw how they live. It's safe, but daughter, it ain't the Hilton. We marched with our helmets, crouched low, and as we approached the end point, which is on the canal, Pomeranz was up front, but the officer I was behind with Rab and Sherman. Believe it or not, a shot was fired. The officer froze and told me in Hebrew to get the hell out of here. He's got enough trouble on his hands. He doesn't need any more. And instinctively, we fell to our knees in the trench leading up to the point and groped our way back. And you could just imagine Sidney Rabb with his white shoes and white pants, because he didn't change. He didn't have any, and that was a mistake. We didn't brief them properly in America that they should have had slacks with them to change on the plane. They left most of their clothing in the hold luggage, which was taken away right at the airport at Lod. So he crawled back on his knees, the hell with the white pants. Mackenda Hargett there, you know. So we crawled back to the middle of the strong point, which is safe because it's below surface, even though it's exposed to the sky, but it's protected all around. Climbed onto the half track, tore our way back the hell out of there onto the main road, and halfway back to the base, we got off the half track and got into a command car, which was a little easier on Pomeranz's ass. And we got back to the base, waiting for the helicopter, and we had some more coffee, some more tea. A nice young non-com Israeli girls of the army taking care of us. And then the first puncture flap took place. We had to wait for an hour and a quarter for the helicopter, which was coming with the group that had gone up to the Mediterranean coast. And when we learned when they arrived that one of the helicopters broke down, so they had to fetch another one. Be that as it may, we got back to Birgavgafa. It was practically dark. The other group had left already, returning to Jerusalem. And we were taken in, debriefed by General Lahat, who was gracious enough to come back to say goodbye over some more tea and coffee. He asked for questions, but it was really very late. So we climbed back again on the helicopter, took our things that we had left in the billets, and flew back to Jerusalem, arriving at Columbia at about 7:15 p.m. It was a longer ride because we couldn't use a Herald. We had to come in at dark at Columbia, so we used the helicopter, the Superfellon, all the way from Bir G back to Jerusalem, Columbia Airport. The cars were there. We jumped into the cars, and we came to the hotel. I scooted over to our field marshal, who was submerged, and told him about the snorkel, which unfortunately we couldn't get, but he appreciates the sentiment. And we told him again, remember, nobody surfaces, and he didn't. And we prepared for the briefing of the group leaders. So I dashed back home. Oh, I came back to the hotel, and Golda was talking to the people. Some of them had a chance to dress and change. Some were sitting there with their uniforms. Iban was there, Golda was there, Teddy Kollek was there, and Zev Sheriff, finance minister. She began to entertain questions, which she was not supposed to do because they were supposed to rest. Then finally, Larry Weinberg's wife, God bless her, said to the prime minister, well, what you asked in your letter about consulting with us and seeking our help, what kind of help did you have in mind? So Golda realized that she was going to blow the cover, so she said, well, let's talk about that tomorrow, eat something light, and go to bed. And the thing broke up, and then I corralled Rickless and Lipson. Ginsburg had dinner with Herb, and Bill, who was already in the hotel, had spoken to her. We had a meeting in the agency, and we arranged the groups. And it was then that the masterstroke was decided to move Saul Steinberg from Lipson's group over to the group number one with the heavy tanks. And we then arranged everything. Chaim and the Cards printed the invitations for the time, the appointments of the prime minister and the groups. We hit the sack. I was all exhausted. And the next morning, we got up very early. And we were driven out to Deir Yassin, which was the heliport for the departure in the morning, on Tuesday morning. And it was a gorgeous day. It was a 30-minute ride over to Kfar Upin. And that was very, very impressive, because in the auditorium, Menachem, one of the heads of the kibbutz, spoke to us, told us what life is about in Kfar Upin. 3 weeks ago, a 15-year-old was killed by shrapnel. He ran out of his bunker hoping to save somebody in one of the buildings, and he was hit. And he made the point that the army keeps life normal. And he hasn't given up the hope that his children, not his grandchildren, but his children would play football, soccer, with the children of the Arab farmers on the other side of the Jordan, most of whom, unfortunately, have fled. And then the colonel in charge of the area briefed us on what the army tries to do to absorb the blows of the Fatah, the terrorists, and the artillery, to serve as a barrier, absorbing the hatred, the hostility of the Fatah, so that the men, women, and children and continue working, studying, living, learning, and leading a relatively normal life. Then we broke up the groups. No, excuse me. Then Dado El-Azhar, the head of the Northern Command, explained the general situation, and in a few terse phrases expressed his appreciation for the visit and the participation of these distinguished citizens who came from a far distance for a short but meaningful trip. They broke up into groups, crisscrossed throughout the kibbutz, into the shelters, through binoculars and telescopes overlooking the Jordan, the little small manufacturing. There was a fellow there from England who supervised the manufacture of galvanometers, and Freddie Pomerantz said he needed a galvanometer very badly. I don't know what for. Mailman began to ask him what the cost price is, and the super financial brains are working all the time, but everybody's in a damn good mood. The sun is shining, the weather is beautiful. And then at about 20 after 11, Moshadi arrives, the Minister of Defense, and with his charismatic personality, captivates everybody. I was sitting in the balcony with Eddie, and as he walked in, he noticed Eddie from below, and he asked him in a loud voice, "Eddie, come down here, sit alongside me, don't leave me here alone." Eddie came down, and Ali Baler very wisely said, "Eddie, you introduced the Minister of Defense," and Eddie used a few brief words, effective sentences about the man of the hour, many times, 48, 56, and 67, and he introduced Moshe Dayan, and Moshe Dayan said to the people, "Now you see why I wanted Eddie to introduce me." He was good, although not everything he said was accurate. Dayan was extremely effective. He spoke as a, not as a soldier, but as a leader, almost a spiritual leader, referring to the Bible. He showed them a dagger that was the weapon with which the Israelites had conquered Palestine under the leadership of Joshua over 3,000 years ago. And he said to them very aptly, "This is not a phantom, but this is the weapon with which they conquered the land." And of course, everybody got the point. Then he went on to explain why, in his judgment, four reasons explain the survival of the Jewish people down the ages. He answered questions. As I said, he was extremely effective. And then we left, boarded the buses, back to the helicopters outside the kibbutz, flew back to Jerusalem, and arrived at 5 to 1 at the Prime Minister's office. It was very dramatic how we landed at her heliport right outside the office. We jumped out, went upstairs, washed our hands, went into the room adjacent to her private office, which filled up quickly, sat down and had lunch. Sapir was there, of course, Golda, Sheriff, Begin, Moshe Kol, the Minister of Tourism, Pincus, Dulcin, Rivlin, Agmon, Dinitz, Arnon, and we sat down in an informal way and had lunch, and after lunch, Golda spoke briefly, turned the mic over to Zev Sheriff, who delivered himself of a very moving address, taking them into his confidence on the latest developments in immigration and the number of tanks that the Egyptians have received and what all this means in terms of money and unanticipated expenditures and the dire situation Israel faces in the immediate future. Gold entertained a few questions, and then Fred Pomerantz, who just couldn't stop talking all day, said, "Well, I think we should all get together here, you know, and buy a phantom, and I'm ready to start." And then she realized that that would have killed the whole deal, so she said, "Fine, let's adjourn, and I'll see you all in a little while." She went into our office. I kept the first group there. And let me tell you what happened now. It was we were a little late. It was about 20, 25 after 3. And I sat in there with the first group. She said a few words, and she made the point that she was hopeful that something dramatic would happen on this special day. And that was the point and purpose of this visit, to talk to you, to consult with you on many things, to share problems, but hoping that something dramatic would happen. So the first guy who spoke up, not according to plan, of course, because you know who the leader of group number one was. The first guy who spoke up was not Bill, but Colonel Henry Crown. And he says, Madam Prime Minister, I can assure you that I'm going to increase. I'm sitting there with his wife. He says, we've decided to increase very, very substantially this year, and I know you're going to be gratified. But he didn't mention a figure. And so the sweat began to roll down my back. And then Bill came in and said a few pleasant words, which culminated with that ringing declaration, $1 million. And he was applauded. And then Colonel Henry Crown said, Madam Prime Minister, that's precisely what I had in mind. And so my sweat down my back turned into tears of joy, and I felt, brother, we're on the way. And then Arthur Cohn spoke in his behalf and behalf of Charlie Basin, a little speech. His wife was sitting there alongside him, Charlie's daughter, $1 million. And then the blockbuster came. Saul P. Steinberg, 30 years old, never been in Israel, never gave a nickel to any campaign for Israel, quietly says that he's flattered by the invitation, he's been inspired by what he saw, and he will contribute $1 million. And that was really very, very moving. And then Louis Rogo got up. He stood up. And he was speaking 2, 3, 4 minutes. The next thing, he had tears in his eyes. His throat choked up. He couldn't continue. But when he got through with the tears and when the choking stopped, he announced $500,000. And then Nate Cummings, or maybe Nate was before Rogo, I don't remember exactly. Yeah, he said to Henry Crown and Bill that he's not in their class, he couldn't manage it, but he's going to do $500,000. David Hanlon, $350,000. He has to speak to his brother, but he's sure that there won't be any problem. And then Morris Messing, $250,000. Belfer, Jesselson, and Russell didn't say anything. Rab said that he's got to consult his family. And he was going to talk to Feldberg. I slipped a note to Bill and told him that we hadn't heard from these three. And after the meeting out in the hall, when we broke up, he explained to me that he had spoken to Mrs. Russell, but that he was keeping a gift in confidence. I gather it's $300,000. Jesselson told him that he doesn't do it this way. He has to go back to New York, but Bill said to me that Jesselson alluded to $1 million, so Bill felt pretty good about that. Arthur Belfer said he's going to have a meeting in his home. I don't know exactly what that means, but I guess by now you guys may know what it means. Be that as it may, we were floating in the clouds because this first group was really tremendous. There were $4 million gifts, and the highlight, of course, was Saul Steinberg with Henry Crown not far behind. Everybody felt good. Group two came in and started off right. She was brief and reckless as pre-planned, came through with $500,000. It was good that I got into the meeting the night before because he was thinking of 300, 350 because we made him a group leader, and Herb asked him to make a $500,000 club. He says, all right, you back me into a corner. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'll do a half. And he told it to Golda. Then we got involved in a long political discussion. I began to sweat. The thing went for over a half hour, and we hadn't earned a nickel. And I slipped it out to Rickless, and I asked him to please get the thing back on the track. And the man who saved it was Larry Weinberg, who was asking a lot of questions and was happy. He felt that he was brought to be consulted, and he wanted to get some opinions from on high on certain political problems. And then he announced $500,000. His wife was there with him, got a big round of applause. And Larry Tisch came through, and he said in a loud voice, Madam Prime Minister, at least $500,000, and he's going to discuss the situation with his brother, and he's certain it's going to be more. Mrs. Farkas said she was authorized to go only $200,000. Her husband had done something with Teddy Kollek. Herb is looking into it. Simon Chilowich said that he doesn't know what his father's going to do. It's about $275,000 or so, $270,000, but he's going to do $100,000 on his own, separate. And that was appreciated. Felberg says he can't commit now, but he's going to be, as he has been, Max Felberg, the largest contributor in Boston. Oh, he was in my group also in the half track in Sinai. And Norman Kahn said $350,000, definite, and then we'll see. Fred Pomeranz said at least $200,000. A little bit of a letdown for all his speech making all day. And Mailman, we knew this in advance, was moved by the whole experience. But not prepared at this time. We do it with the family and we let it go with that. There was no pressure, no embarrassment. Everybody felt good. They moved out and the group number three came in. Started off magnificently. Nate Lipson responded as pre-planned with $600,000. Jack Warner surprised everybody. Talked a lot, interrupted, but came up with $500,000. And then we ran into trouble. Max Stryoff, him and his brother, said $350,000, which I understand is a $100,000 increase. But Ellis Kopp, and I had a long thing with him the night before because it was a terrible misunderstanding between him and me and the Prime Minister, apparently, because Ted Shambaum, you know, I took him in about 3 weeks ago, when she asked for $1 million and he said half the battle is won, everyone assumed we were talking about $500,000. But it turned out that was not what Ted meant, at least that's what he said he didn't mean. Cop felt so bad about the whole thing that the night before he called Ted in my presence in from his hotel room, got him in Dallas with Greenberg also on the line. It was a very unpleasant conversation because apparently he left with authorization only for $275,000. And apparently Ted, what his Shambaum, when he said half the battle was won, he was referring to that he was convinced that you got to give more. Now it's up to Cop to say you got to go more. Cop said until they sell some stock or something, they couldn't move on that. But his conscience bothered him so badly. And when I said to him that everybody in the government knows it's a $500,000, he said, well, he'll go on his own another $25,000, $300,000. And after the group left Golder, he actually sat with Golder for 5 minutes to explain the confusion. Although Eddie Ginsberg said that Ted Shambaum told him that that half was sure. So I'm confused, and you better talk to Eddie to clarify the situation. Then we ran into trouble. Glazer and Levitt couldn't commit now because it's a public company, which I guess meant they had to talk to Levitt's father. Jerry Morse, very graciously, was really obviously moved by the whole trip, said he has to consult his partner, Albert, and Warner backed him up and told the Prime Minister not to worry about him. He's a great guy, and he's going to come through. Jack Rosen didn't show because apparently he couldn't contact Leonard in Germany, and in my humble judgment, he's not authorized to do anything or say anything. So we really didn't miss much by the fact that he wasn't there. But Nate Shermer was a disappointment. He said his son has grown up and he's got to consult his son. So Midas Muffler, there's a lot of work to be done. And Nate Lipson told me he's got an appointment with him in Chicago. He's going to handle him. The Sherman said to Nate, you get my son interested and you got $1 million. So we got to go to work on that. And Nate says, leave it to me. Penny was the only guy who expressed a little surprise that the thing had emerged somewhat as a fundraising assemblage, although I must say that in all the groups, it came about naturally, without any pressure, and it started with fundraising, went into politics, public relations, ended in fundraising, or the reverse, there was no specific pattern. He was the only guy who expressed some surprise, but he said, I'll see, I'm an old hand at this, Gurney said, I'll do what I can, I gotta determine it when I go back. This group was a disappointment because there were only four gifts, and she felt a little badly. Then the fourth group came in, and while the money wasn't very big, at least you had gifts. So I don't remember how it started now. Let's see, who started it off? Yeah, they sort of went around the room. Oh, Jesus. Who was first? Who was first? Who was first? I don't remember exactly who was first. Oh, yeah, Sam Miller, but he deferred to Leonard, who was sitting across the room, and Leonard made a little speech and said 500,000 plus. And then there was silence, and Donald Robinson picked it up, and he came through with 260,000, which I think is a 100,000 increase. And then Harold Petty came up with 250,000. Fixman said 300,000 minimum, maximum a million, depending on what happens with his stock. Elliot Bernstein said that he's got to convince his brother. He's deeply impressed by what he saw, but it's going to be a substantial increase. Maury Salzman quickly said 300,000. Michael Sussman said that he's gone up 25,000 to 225,000. He was sorry his father couldn't come. Rogo made his speech again, by the way. He was originally part of this group, and he made a speech again and said a half a million, and maybe he can improve, he said, on the half a million that he had promised when he was with the Prime Minister an hour and a half ago in the first group. Jack Lemmon came up with a figure that fouled up the arithmetic, one-third of a million, $333,333. Joe Katz in Pittsburgh said, I promise you it's going to be, his $125,000 will be very handsomely and nicely increased, so that you had a good feeling. And then the questions, discussions, everybody told Golda she should have another such special group invited of handpicked people. And she said to them, you recommend the people who will think about it very seriously. Somebody came up with a suggestion of her sending letters to important people. She very politely explained the difficulties there. Now, you know the figures. With Eddie Ginsberg, we refer to 28 gifts. The first group is 9 gifts at $5,900,000 committed with specific figures. The second group is 7 gifts, $2,630,000. The third group is 4 gifts, $5,900,000 committed with specific figures. The second group is 7 gifts, $2,630,000. The third group is 4 gifts, $1,750,000. The fourth group is 8 gifts, $2,308,000. For a total of $12,588,000. In 1970, 28 gifts produced now $12,500,000. The same 28 gifts in 1967 produced $7,000,000. So there's a $7 million increase from the war, the Six-Day War of 1970. For 28 gifts accounted for, because they're specific, 14 are outstanding. In 1969, $2,205,000. We estimate that was less than 14 gifts, somewhere between 3 million. The Prime Minister's initial reaction was somewhat disappointed in terms of the total, but then realizing what had happened, inspired by certain specific individuals and increases, recognized that this was a tremendous breakthrough. I went over to Herb at the King's Hotel, and there was very little oxygen left. He'd been submerged for so many days. I still couldn't find a snorkel. We went through the calculations, gave him a detailed report. He worked through. Of Warner, who he would call New York. New York should call L.A. I think he spoke to you.
And that should have an electrifying effect in Los Angeles.
And then we went back. I finally had a chance to shave, and we went to Eban's home. The mood was festive. Everybody was there. The dinner was fine. And then Eban spoke, and made a mistake of speaking too long. Beginning at 10 o'clock and finishing at 7 minutes after 11, everybody was exhausted. But Golda took over. But before she could finish her
Nate Lipson got up and made a toast, practically choked.
And then Eddie came to the front of the room and asked for everyone's attention. And when Eddie and I were sitting with Herb in the King's Hotel down below, I made a recommendation that if you got to give the dagger to somebody, that Dayan gave to the group, the implement with which Joshua conquered the Palestine over 3,000 years ago, I says, give it to the youngest guy. Nobody will be feel badly about it. And as far as I'm concerned, Saul Steinbeck's the hero of the World Series. And Eddie did that in a few short sentences. Ovation. Golda was well. Explained that she was moved not only by their presence, but by their emotion. and how they spoke to her in her office in the little groups. And everybody was riding high. I got up the next morning,
gave him a detailed report, came to the
airport, and everything went, as they say in Israel, chick-chock, a kol beseder. Everything was fine. The only problem at the plane was that Fred Pomeranz, my good buddy, left his medicine in the whole luggage. I had to take out three quarters of the bags. And Saul Steinberg also was going to go TWA to Rome. He stopped at Rome, and he came puffing out of the plane. Including Tenzer from New York. And just as they're about ready to close the doors, Bill comes out and screams to me. And I come up, whatever you call it, the gangplank. I said, "What's the matter, Bill?" He says, "I need the totals, the totals." So I gave, went in, they closed the door, and the plane took off, I think, about 15, 20 after. Everybody could make their appointments in New York today. And then Herb came to the airport at about 9:15, with Ethan, the daggers, and he felt pretty good. The peer was on the same plane. I came back to Jerusalem, spoke to Pincus. Mike Arnon called me about the photographers who were at Eban's home to get the pictures to give them to everybody. And
then I come
to sleep. That's the blow-by-blow description of this thing, Pete. And I'm sure that you can derive a hell of a lot of nachas from all the work that we're doing on your side, on our side over here. I think it's a breakthrough. I think it's going to pull a portal. I'm sure Herb is going to talk to you. And after a couple of days' rest, I'm ready for the next one. So now I'm going to sign off and get this as soon as.